This is Paul Leek, interviewed by Chris Alden Lee on the 20th of November, 2013. Paul Leek, Part 2.
Before we start again, Paul, the man whose name you were trying to recall who died in the Antarctic was Alan...
Sharman.
Alan Sharman.
Yep.
Yeah. Tell me about Porth Lockroy and the Beastie work you were doing. What was it called, Beastie?
I don't know. It's a big piece of electronic gear. I mean, I've got a feeling that the word was coined by Jack Tinbergen. He was the one who introduced us to it. Anyway, they called it the Beastie, and that was it. So I guess, it was just something they called it, and that was it, you know. It's like smoko. Why do you call it smoko? Well, smoko is when you have a cup of coffee, you know, or a cup of tea, shall I say, and that's it. You know? It's one of these things. They call it the Beastie. It was kind of... Yeah, between you and me, it was a routine. I mean, what it amounts to... also, between you and me, it was easy work. It was, as we say in England, it was a bobby's job. You know, we didn't have a hell of a lot to do. As far as I'm aware, the reason why there was five guys on base was because Fids decided that that was the minimum size of a base that they could have. And I think there was a certain amount of justification in that. Because the year before, one of the guys took ill, and so they ended up with four guys. And, you know, it's a bit of a chore running the base. The basic thing basically was, as I understand it, was basically we were flying the flag. This was base A, and this was kind of, you know, our initial base.
The guy who was taken ill was the leader, John Smith, wasn't it?
The year before?
Yeah.
What about John Smith? Smith doesn't ring a bell, but it could have been. But
did you meet the person?
Pardon?
Did you meet him on the way out?
Effectively, yes. They were carrying him out when I arrived. I think it was. There was Muir Smith, Jim Muir Smith. As far as I remember, he used the word the surname Muir Smith. That's what I remember anyway. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's.
No,
what
I'm
I
sure
remember.
You're right.
But I'm not good with names, but that's... the Beastie work was... Let me say, it's like all these things, you see. It was electronic, so it was electronic from the 50s. It was basically radar work, radar technology. The electron, I mean, people don't understand it, but nowadays in particular, but electron tubes lasted for a hell of a long time in those days. So basically, there was not a lot of maintenance. Most of the maintenance work that you had was the mechanics. You had, a variable capacitors that bits moved in, and then there was the film transport mechanism. There was a certain amount of mechanics there. But it didn't cause a heck of a lot of trouble at all.
Did it ever go wrong?
Hmm?
Did it ever go wrong?
It did on occasions, yes, but not very often. And, when it did, it was a fairly simple thing to do. We had an oscilloscope and, multimeters and various other things. So we had basically the basis to be able to fix it in almost any eventuality. I'm sure there were a bunch of stuff that could happen to it, but like I say, that stuff was jolly reliable. We had other stuff that we had a bunch of stuff that was not actually official FIDS or official government issue, shall we say.
Go on.
One of these things was the year before. I think it was about a year before Dartmouth College in the States sent a tape recorder down and some tapes and instructed the guys how to build kind of a crude antenna to receive whistlers. And I never heard of whistlers before, but apparently this whole thing apparently grew out of some technology that was discovered, or some stuff that was discovered during the First World War. And what happened was that the people in the, I guess it was the British Army, who the hell knows, but in one of the armies, decided that all the communications between the front and various other places was going on telegraph wires, telephone wires. And they conceived the idea of kind of trying to build big antenna to see if they could pick up electromagnetic signals from these things. I don't think it was very successful on that, but what they heard was kind of surprised them. They could hear these noises like whistles, which went like this, you see. There's a whole bunch of other, but they could hear them, you see. So what it amounts to is that Dartmouth decided they were going to do some research and find out what these were and various, and see what other stuff they could do. So what it amounts to is they sent this tape recorder down with a tape and instructions how to build like a crude antenna, or maybe they connected it up to the antenna at the base. But anyway, the guys complied with this and sent the tapes back. And then they got a furious message from Dartmouth saying, okay, who's the guy with the microphone? And so they said, well, what do you mean? Well, you guys can't possibly have been hearing that. You know, there's no background noise, there's no hum, there's no nothing. You know, whistles aren't that clear. And he said, well, they are here. So Dartmouth then really got into gear and they sent a whole pile of bloody tapes down for us and the tape recorder and some other gear, because they wanted to do. So the idea was this tape recorder switched itself on. The idea was it was supposed to switch itself on every hour and record for, you know, 10, 15, I can't remember what the numbers were. And we said, that ain't going to work, because the beastie goes on it on the hour and it's on for 5 minutes and you ain't going to get diddly squat. So I said, okay. So they changed the timing. And but the whistle recording was kind of cute. I mean, the thing is, what happened is that the whistlers are lightning flashes in the Northern Hemisphere, in the United States in particular. They travel along the lines of magnetic force on the Earth, and they come down a long time later, or several, you know, seconds later. But they don't come down as a bang. Path is what's known as a dispersive medium, and so what it does is it makes high frequencies travel faster than low frequencies. So instead of coming down as a like that, it comes down as a, you see. But they were even more fascinated by the fact that not only were we clear as a bell and they could hear every bloody thing, but they could also hear double whistlers that went. And they came to the conclusion those were lightning flashes in the Southern Hemisphere, which went north, bounced back and came back down again, you see. But to be quite honest with you, I didn't actually follow this, but I know that there's a whole bunch of other stuff. We got all sorts of other noises on there. Some of them were kind of repetitive, like which we call wagon wheels. And there's another one that was like a twitter, that we call Dawn Chorus. And, you know, what you meant is you could sit there and you'd be looking at the tape recorder, and they had a VU meter on there that showed you what was happening. And sometimes you see a lot of activity and you think, what the hell is that? You know, and you could see this thing jumping up and down. It's really weird. So I don't know what conclusion Dartmouth came to, but it was kind of a cute experiment, shall we say.
So yeah. Two questions then. One is, was this official liaison between Dartmouth College and, is it Rhode Island?
Yeah, America? Dartmouth College in Rhode Island, yeah.
Was it official liaison between Dartmouth College and FIDS, or were you doing this on the quiet?
No, I'm pretty sure it was through FIDS. I'm pretty sure it was done officially through the British government. Okay. It was some sort of a liaison there. I mean, it didn't occupy any significant amount of our time. And in fact, when I first arrived there, the guys, including, because Jack Timbergen was still there, we all got together because they wanted to put up an extra antenna, a special antenna, over on the Penguin Rookery. which was even quieter because it was now, you know, about 50, 60, 100 yards away from everything on the base, so there was no interference whatsoever. And they put that there, and then they had a wire going under the sea to into the base. So it was that, and I'm sure, I don't know who paid for that, but I would guess it was FIDS paid for it, and you know what the. Go ahead.
Was there any talk of practical application to this discovery or these readings?
Well, let me say, I mean, there was no talk about any particular practical, not as far as the whistlers were concerned. Now, as far as the Beastie work was concerned, there was practical application there, like I say, because all communications was with the ionosphere. And what we used to do was we used to take the data and we'd basically create a précis of the data every month. And that would get sent back to head office. The other thing is, the other piece of research that we did was for the US Navy, I think it was. But what they did was they wanted to test communications at 15 kilohertz. And so what they did was they sent us a receiver down to which would receive data at 15 kilohertz. And we had to do the same sort of thing with that, record that. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was kind of cute, that, because they were trying to somehow or other, they were doing some tests as to whether they could use this to communicate with submarines. Apparently 15 kilohertz penetrates a certain distance in the sea, so they wanted to do that. But I thought it was kind of fun, that, because I could tune this thing up, because at that time I could actually hear 15 kilohertz, so I could tune this down thing up by ear, which I thought was absolutely incredible that I could tune a radio up without just using my own ears.
This cable under the sea from the aerial, the new aerial, back to the hut, had an episode, didn't it?
Yeah, well, we had a bit of fun with that. It was... what it amounts to is the cable came into the hut, into the Beastie room, through a hole that we drilled in the window. And there was one day, there was me and I think it was me and Bunny Austin, we sat there and we were chatting, or maybe working, who the hell knows. But anyway, all of a sudden there's a little bit of a noise, and we looked up and we could see this wire, because the wire came through and it splashed onto a couple of other wires. And it was kind of moving, and all of a sudden the wires started moving and getting pulled out through the hole and broke the contact with the other wires. And we thought, what the hell's happening? So we went out, and what we saw was there was a bergy bit was busy steaming through the channel between the base, between our island and the main, or the other island, Winky Island there. And he was obviously caught on this cable. And there was a discussion between me and, like I say, I think it was Bunny, but I'm not sure, between the two of us as to whether to grab hold of the wire and hold it or let it go. And we decided that it was better to let it go, because otherwise it was going to take us out to sea with it. There was no stopping that darn thing. It was on its way. So anyway, we didn't bother about it, and what it amounts to is it kind of dropped it. The cable kind of came free, and we had to put it back in through the hole. But it must have just caught, because the thing is that when we put the cable down, we just kind of, you know, laid it down in the channel, so it could have had a loop in there or something. So
had you in fact tried to do an aerial connection at one point? Not an aerial, I mean a wire in the air.
Well, what they did was they built a, I think that was a triangle. The idea with the antennas were all basically a loop, what they call a loop antenna. They weren't because the thing is, if you put wires in the air, if you're not careful, you get a dipole. It works at one frequency. You get a loop, tends to work better, especially at the low frequencies. It works a lot better. And these were, you know, well, the whistlers were, you know, audio frequency. They were, you know, a few kilohertz down to maybe, you know, half a kilohertz, something like that. They weren't real high frequencies.
But the wire that carried the signal from the aerial back to your hut
Yeah.
Did you not try initially to have that go over water rather than under it?
No. No, there was no idea. Well, maybe there was with other people, because I just arrived when they were fixing on putting that in. But I think maybe they talked about it. But the thing is that was too difficult. I mean, the fact of the matter is that, you know, with the sort of winds we get, then, you know, it would need a I mean, as it was, that the aerial blew down at least once. I mean, on the rookery, at least once it blew down, and we had to, re-erect the damn thing, because, you know, you got 100 mile an hour wind, it's powerful stuff. And it's not easy to find something to fasten into. You know, the ground is either frozen or it's got snow on it. It's not an easy task to do. So it was much better to put it underneath. Like I say, I agree with you. I believe there was some talk about that, but we decided that it was much better to go underwater.
Why was monitoring the Whistlers so important?
I don't know. as far as I'm concerned, that was interesting. Well, that was blue sky research, but it was kind of interesting to.
So it was pure research without any plan to use the information later.
No, as far as I'm aware, no. I'm difficult to find any way that you could use it, but it was kind of. I found it interesting. I'm not sure what, like I say, I'm not sure what Dartmouth did with the results, but it was kind of. It was blue sky research. But of course, the research, as far as the Navy was concerned, communicating at 15 kilohertz, that's some use to them, at any rate.
So that was the ionospheric work you were doing. The importance of that was a bit more obvious, was it?
Yeah, the ionospheric work was basically, we ran the Beastie. When I got there, it was the end of the IGY, I guess it was. And they've been doing some research on absorption in the D layer, and when I was there, we did one of the last runs of that, and there's some discussion about that. Well, you've got to be up all night. Okay, well, we'll be up all night, so we're running the. We had a special piece of equipment that the guys had put together that worked at really low frequencies. I can't remember what it was now, but it was below the frequencies that the Beastie ran at to measure the absorption in the lowest layer, the D layer. And, you know, we ran it specifically at night because that's when the D layer was most evident.
Were there ever any unusual results, any surprises?
I don't think so, no. I mean, apart from the Whistlers, they were kind of, they were a bit of a surprise to everybody, but I don't remember any real surprises, no. I mean, the data was pretty much what you would expect. We didn't have any breakthroughs or anything happening that was completely unexpected, no.
So why were you... Because this was work that was begun in the IGY year, wasn't it? 2 years prior to you.
No, this...
Huh? Sorry, have I got that wrong? Tell me.
As far as I'm aware, what happened was... maybe I'm out of line, but as far as I'm aware, what happened was that the FIDS or whoever it was at the time started at base A, and then from what I hear or what I heard, base A was a great place, very nice place, nice anchorage and everything, except it had two major disadvantages. One was that it wasn't connected to the mainland, so it was a bit of a bugger to get doing its fledging, and the second was that it had its own, in their words, microclimate, so it wasn't giving you a heck of a lot of information about the meteorology either. And I think one of the things was that, and I'm just inferring, I mean, like I said, I was a young lad then.
Yeah,
I'm inferring from what's happened later, and I infer from later stuff that first thing was that, you know, during the war they decided they had to have a base down there, and they kept the flag flying. And second thing is, well, we've got to do something with it. So I'll tell you what we'll do, ionospheric research. That's my, and it, you know, from some respects, it was ideal for that. Okay, the climate was, you know, by their standards, relatively benign. I wouldn't say it was all that benign, but relatively benign. And it was fairly easy to get at, and it was about as far south, because far south as they could reliably go. And so we met a lot of nice criteria. And I believe that the reason why they closed it down the year after I was there was because they just decided, you know, this is daft. We've got five guys here, and basically there's only one of them, and he's only working half his bloody time anyway. So, you know.
Well, I wonder whether you felt any echoes of that in your time, whether you felt that after you've been there a while, you felt the work you were doing was probably not terribly important, really.
No, we always felt that the work was important from the point of view that it was very important as far as world communications are concerned. You know, we felt we were in a unique position. Like I say, we were in a situation where we had Antarctic weather as far as the sun was concerned, but as far as the geomagnetic. Situation was concerned, we were on the opposite side of the Antarctic. So, you know, you could theoretically sort out the effects of different things. So from our point of view, the work we did was important. As I said, wasn't a problem, it was very nice. You know, you had a lot of time on your hands. But the problem from Fitz's point of view was that, you know, it didn't really take five guys to do the work that we were doing. Mm-hmm. Now, it may be you could turn around and say, from the point of view of world communications, our work was maybe more important than anybody else's. You don't know. but, you know, that's how we felt. And like I say, I was not in a position where I was interested in analysing these things. I was straight out of college, and as far as I was concerned, it was a great place to be, and you know, that was great. Mm. But you know, I believe that when they closed Lockroy down, they moved everything down to the Argentine islands, and probably just had one guy working on it part time down there. I don't know. And now they're down at. Where's that place down, the new place down that they've got down there?
Sky Blue? Halley, Sky Blue, Fossil Bluff?
No. I think they probably, well, if they're doing any work at all, they may have quit doing that entirely because, you know, as I said, the ionosphere has decreased in importance significantly because of the advent of satellite and cable communications. You don't need it. But, you know, in our day, it was very important. And, you know, it was also, you know, it was great fun because we'd get up on the amateur radio and we'd have some idea as to what was happening. And all the other guys were working blind and we'd say, okay, I can see there's a solar flare. And
well, part of the process was a photographic process. You had your own darkroom.
Well, yes, what they did was, the way the Beastie worked was, it had a I explained the whole thing. It worked like a radar, only different. What it had was it had a transmitter there, excuse me, that transmitted radio waves up in pulses. The pulses were about, I can't remember now, maybe 5-10 microseconds long. They had a tube there that amplified them, and they were from about 100 kilohertz, maybe 50 kilohertz, up to 25 megahertz. But they were in bands, and you could, I think there's some like five bands. I got a brochure for the damn thing somewhere or other. But anyway, there's about five bands. And we didn't necessarily use them all because the top band almost never occurred. But what it amounts to is you could use any of these five bands. And what happened was you send a pulse of a radio up, and basically like a radar, you wait until it came back and measured how long it took. And what they did to record this was we had a cathode ray tube which showed the pulse, and then when the pulse came back, it showed the pulse coming back. And we actually had two cathode ray tubes. One was sort of what they call a PPI, I think it used called plant position indicator, where you could see the two pulses, and you could see the difference, you know, the distance or the delay, shall we say, when the one came back. And the other one worked just by having changed the illumination, so it got bright when there was a pulse, and it got bright when you could see a pulse coming back. And that one, what happened was then we had a film that went past that, and as it went along, the frequency of the radio going up scanned through whatever frequency they decided to start with, which was, I say, about 50, 100 kilohertz, and it ran up to whatever we decided to stop at. And you could see, it basically was showing how far up the ionosphere was. The ionosphere, there's two layers, or three layers, because there's the E layer, the F layer, and the F2 layer. And what happens is radio goes through a certain frequency, the radio waves go further and further into the layer until eventually they pop through, and then you can see the next layer, and the next layer comes in, and then you get the same with the next layer, and then it kind of folds off right on the end of the F2, then it basically everything goes out into space. And by looking at this, we had a special transparency, shall we say, with a curve on it, which was designated. You just ran that along, and you could see. You looked at where the end of the curve was, and it told you what sort of frequency that was. And you said, okay, the frequency is this, so this is the MUF, the maximum usable frequency. It's all coming back to me. So that was the maximum usable frequency. And what you did was then was you just you categorized that for every run, which was every hour, for the whole day, and then you would basically at the end, I think it was every month, but maybe it was every day, I can't remember now, that got shipped, that data got shipped back to Port Stanley.
Shipped back?
No, it was radioed back to
Morse, Port, by yeah. Morse.
Yeah, 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 by the radio operator.
And you had a radio operator in the team to do that?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, we had a radio operator. The team was radio operator, diesel mechanic, and then there were three others.
hence the easy shifts. Hence the easy shifts.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The shifts were even easier than that, because basically you could leave, that machine would run something like 3 days. Yeah. You know, you could put enough film in there so the damn thing would run for 3 days. So you basically, then you'd take the film out and you'd develop it. And we had a developing tank hooked up, so you just develop the darn film. And, you know, we could basically do the readouts, you know, at our leisure, shall we say, as we say in the States, at our leisure. You know, the basic data reduction was, maybe 2 or 3 hours' work. So
would any one of you do that? So was the one person specifically in charge of interpreting the results or notating the results?
Any one of the ionosphericists would do that. There was basically, first year I was there, there was Alan, me and George Lewis. So we would basically share that between us on some sort of a basis, you know, okay, you know, I'm going to do some development film and stuff like that. So you know, we would share it up without any big deal. The second year, there was just two of us. There's me and Bunny Austin were the two ionosphericists. So I wouldn't say we were overworked, to be quite honest with you. But
one of the reasons there were five of you is because, of course, you had to run a base. You had to actually live.
That's right.
And there's a heck of a lot of manual and physical and routine domestic work involved.
Right.
And I was interested to read about the getting the oil drums ashore when you first arrived. It must have been quite a trial.
Well, when I first arrived, we were getting the oil drums. Well, let me say this: getting the oil drums ashore was a pain in the neck, and those things were very heavy. They were English 40-gallon drums, so they had a lot of weight. They weighed about £200-300, I believe. And they tended to have diesel oil in the outside, which made it a little bit of a chore to move the damn things. The biggest problem, actually, was other bases. Because other bases, you were landing on rocks. Some places you were landing, you're thinking to yourself, you've got to be nuts getting off a bloody boat here. I mean, it was a real pain in the neck. At Port LaCroix, it was easy. We had a jetty. We could pull the bloody scow up to the jetty. We didn't actually have a crane on the jetty, but we could have done. But it was dead easy to do stuff at Port LaCroix because the jetty was there, and you could unload stuff real easy. It was not so much of a chore, and you could get the stuff ashore and you just roll it up a fair distance. And if there's any snow, you just roll it and just stood all the bloody. Then you had to make sure you stood all the barrels in a line. Because otherwise you would get, if you stood them the wrong way, you stood them in the line the right way, that was fine. But if you stood them the wrong way, they would cause drifts and you would only be able to get at one load of barrels because the rest the rest would be on the snow.
So you aligned the barrels to be in a straight line down.
You knew which way to align them by the, by people right. Told you which way to align them. Yeah. So we aligned the barrels the right way now. And we had the barrels all set up. But the biggest problem with Port LaCroix was it was easier to unload the barrels. The problem was there was a lot more of them because we were running 24 hours a day. So we're basically at least 10, maybe 20 times as many barrels. So that was a pain in the neck from that point of view. But and what happened was we had all the barrels lined up, and then what happened is the diesel mechanic would then have a hand pump they'd use, and he'd pump the oil up to the diesel shed. We call it a diesel shed. Diesel shed, where he had a tank there which actually ran the two diesels. I'm not sure how many barrels there were. Probably, I would guess offhand, I would say there's about 50, but I'm sure Dave Price would tell you exactly how many.
A diesel mechanic. Because you were so dependent upon 24-hour power, did you ever lose it? Was there ever any problems with that?
We didn't have, I don't ever remember us actually losing power. It's possible we did. I know we had problems with, at one point in the second year, Evan Watson had a problem with one of the diesels, and he had to, we all had to muck in and help him rebuild the damn thing, but That's the only, but I don't ever remember the actual losing power. But we almost certainly did. But then we had three generators anyway. We had the two Listers, and then we still had one of the old Enfields as well.
Yeah, as a backup.
Yeah. So the Listers, they would run. I'm not sure what the schedule was, but probably run it for a week or maybe a couple of weeks, and then switch over to the other one and do whatever maintenance they felt like doing.
Did you make any alterations to the base?
Yeah, we did make some alterations. We built a porch out the front. I don't remember doing it, but apparently Alan and I were the ones who did it. So I mean, but I don't actually remember doing it. And we also built the, if I remember rightly, we built the dark room that we were using. Because what happened was that they had the new diesel shed, and the old diesel shed was still there. It was there, and if I remember rightly, I got involved with helping to build the dark room, which is part of the old diesel shed. And then what happened was that the old dark room, which must have been really bloody pokey, I can tell you, because it was really small. But the old dark room became the base office that Alan used to do all his official paperwork, stamp the stamps and all that stuff, I've still got some of those stamps with Port LaCroix stamp on them.
So have I.
Yeah, but mine are older than yours.
Yeah, they are. There was a certain amount of interior decoration went on as well, I believe.
That's kind of funny, that, yes. Well, the first... See, the thing is, you see, you've got a bunch of guys with not a lot of with a lot of time on their hands, and especially in the winter, you know, the thing is, you see, that you talk to people about the Antarctic, they say, oh, it's cold, 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 cold. The cold isn't a big deal. What people don't understand is that in the winter, there ain't no light. You know, you can say, okay, we were below the Antarctic Circle, so we didn't lose light daylight completely, but with bloody Mount Francais up there and the glacier opposite, we basically lost sunlight for 2 months.
Yeah.
You know? So what it amounts to is that, and you know, when we did have sunlight, at best we had twilight for maybe, depending upon how you felt about it, an hour, maybe a couple of hours at midday. So you've got a lot of time on your hands, a lot of time. So people, to their credit, Fids had kind of worked this out, I think. So they gave us a lot of paint. You know, and you know, this is the old Navy trick, you see. I mean, and we discovered that on the ship when we're going down. You know, the guys are stood around with nothing to do. Well, the first thing you do is, okay, you get a chipper and you get a paintbrush and to paint anything. You know, the old Navy adage is, if it paints, if it moves, salute it. If it don't, paint it, you see. So, there was a good deal of painting went on. And then the second year, we had this guy, Evan Watson. He was a diesel mechanic. And what happened was that he, like everybody else, had a certain amount of time on his hands. So he decided he was going to paint himself a picture of a young lady, a pinup, a life-size pinup, in the diesel shed. I forget which one it was now. Can't remember, but I believe it's still there. So anyway, he painted this. And of course, everybody says, hey, that's a good idea. I want one of them. So we all had a pinup painted. I wanted Audrey Hepburn, but somebody beat me to that one, so I had somebody else. And what I said was, well, I want a pinup, but I want one that's naked. So I want one with no clothes on, you see? So he painted me with one with no clothes on. I forget who the hell it was he painted, but it was a rear view, so it wasn't... No, that's fine. A rear view of some young... I forget who the hell it was I chose, but anyway...
A film star or something.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We had the... we'd got lots of pictures we could choose, you see. But anyway, he painted them all on the doors of our lockers, and they painted at least three on the walls in the bunk room. And he decided, having heard what I said, he decided this, he was going to go all the way. He painted, I think it was Jane Russell, above his bed, full size, full frontal nudity. Which was kind of interesting, because this is in the days when you didn't get a lot of magazines. You not got a lot of feedback on full frontal nudity. And so he didn't quite get what he wanted. So then he painted a pair of knickers on her and a... I think he painted a top on her. He made her more modest, and I don't quite know what happened, because apparently that stuff was still there the year afterwards. But after that, a lot of that stuff disappeared, and some of the paintings have now reappeared, still on the walls. But Evan Watson was the guy who did it. He was actually, you know, bearing in mind that, you know, he didn't have the painter's gear. He didn't have the right paints. I mean, he was making whatever paints he could up from a bunch of paints which were intended for painting walls. He did quite a crack up job.
So were the stars recognizable?
Yeah, well, let me say, yes, they were, yes, yes, they were quite recognisable, yes, when you got them full face, they were actually, like I say, I mean, let's face it, what we had was basically publicity pictures, and as you know as well as I do, they don't particularly like the person anyway. I mean, you look at a star, if you actually meet a star in the flesh, you say, Oh, you don't look like a picture, mate.
So was there any communication with the fairer sex at all? Was there radio, letters, correspondence, magazines?
That's kind of interesting. There was a certain amount of communication. I always maintain I'm a lucky guy. And in some respects, I'm the luckiest guy. What it amounts to is that the guys would go up, and Dave Price is a prime example. He would go up on the radio, because we all had a mammoth to radio call signs. He would go up on the radio and start trying to talk to people in England and trying to communicate with his family and stuff like that. And one day, he came in to me, and he says, "I found somebody in Derbyshire." I said, and I was a little non-committal. Okay, Derbyshire's a big place. He says, "This guy is near Chesterfield." I said, "Well, okay, that's a promising start, you see." So anyway, I said, "Okay, I'll talk to him, you see." So I got up on the radio, and I was talking to this guy. He says, "Oh, his name's Alex Bowyer." I says, "Okay." I says, "Well," I says, "yeah," I says, "yeah, I come from there. I live down at Thorn Lane, you see." He says, "Oh," he says, "well, I'm in North Wingfield." I says, "Oh, okay, that's right next door." He says, "We're in Epthorn Lane, you see." So I says, "you know, 72 Epthorn Lane, you see." He says, "Okay," yes, and we chatted for a bit. Then he says, "Hang on a minute." And his voice comes on, and it's my mother. He says, "Oh," I says, "oh, hello, Mum." So I was talking to my mum and dad, you see, and Alex comes back on. He says, "Oh, yeah," he says, "I just sent my brother down. While we were talking, I sent my brother down to," he says, "your house is only 5 minutes away by car." So I sent my brother down and said, "Hey, well, you want to talk to your Paul?" So I talked to my mother and me dad and my sister, the one that's in there.
Linda. Were you tongue-tied by the surprise? Or
I was a little taken aback. Yeah. Yeah, so what we did was we established a regular sked, as they call it, and I used to ring. I used to talk to them. Well, I tried to talk to them once a week, but the thing is that radio communications were not that reliable, as I knew. This was probably in the spring, you know, the Antarctic spring, and I got through to them. So I was able to talk for, you know, a month or so, and then we couldn't, and then we could talk again a little later on. So, you know, we got to a stage where we could talk for maybe 2 or 3 months at a time.
Spring and autumn.
You know, once a week, and then the conditions were... In the winter, the conditions were no good because there was not enough sun, and in the summer, conditions were no good because there was too much sun. It was, you know, it screwed the atmosphere up.
What was the attitude of FIDS towards those kind of communications? Were they tolerant or...?
I don't think... I didn't have any reactions. I mean, as far as FIDS is concerned, I don't think that they would have any real concern about it. Let me put it this way. I'm sure FIDS would be only too happy about it. Officially, it was illegal.
Exactly, you know?
Yeah. We weren't supposed to communicate except through the GPO in England was concerned, but I'm sure the GPO would turn around and say, "Hey, you can do it. Get on with it, mate."
Communication was supposed to go through Stanley, is that?
Well, communications, no. I mean, the FIDS had no problem about you going up and talking on the radio, amateur radio. Let me put it this way. As you can see, they've got a bunch of guys, especially on our base, who are kind of tied to base. They're bored. Mm. So, you know, anything that keeps the buggers happy is from Fitz's point of view, is a good idea.
Was there any sense of that, of being able to communicate with home, a kind of dual-edged sword? I ask this question because today, of course, they can communicate any time they like.
Right.
And there are FIDS who say, actually, it's a distraction, it's a pain. And, you know, you get your missus on the phone saying, "The boiler's bust, what do I do?" And you're the other side of the planet and there's nothing you can do apart from... So it also can accentuate homesickness. Did you have any of those kind of problems?
Well, let me say, as far as I was concerned, it was great. We didn't talk for... I mean, I'm not the sort of guy who can get on the phone now and talk for... I mean, you may think that I'm talking at great length here, but I'm not the sort of guy...
45 minutes later. Get,
yeah. I mean, if I'm talking to my wife on the phone, I don't talk for very long. Okay. So I'm not... And
so it didn't have any ill effects?
As far as I'm concerned, it was great. I mean, the only problem was the other guys were jealous because nobody managed to achieve anywhere close to the communication that I got. But I'm sorry about that. But, you know, I just so happened that this guy...
it was serendipity, wasn't it?
I'm just trying to remember his name now. Huh.
Don't worry.
Anyway, but his last name was Bowyer. And actually, Alec... I was talking to him, and Alec was his brother. And when I got back, it was, you know, I went and visited him. And we used to, you know, have Christmas together and stuff like that. It was a nice. In fact, I inspired him to go and work on the Deal Line up in northern Canada. But you know, as far as I'm concerned, it was not a problem for most of the guys, for the simple reason that none of them had any real strong ties back home. I mean, you say now, okay, the wife's on the same, the boy. I mean, I don't think any of them were married.
Yeah.
There was one or two of my girlfriends, and of course, that was always the thing about, you know, you get a Dear John letter. You know, I believe that Fids was, although they were assiduous about it, but they were kind of real keen on getting guys who were didn't have any emotional attachments back home because. You know, you're cut off for 2 years, basically, and that was it.
What's all this about this, the Woman's Own magazine?
That was funny. I can't remember. What it amounts to is it was Base O, I think. I forget what the name of the place is, but what it amounts to is that Fed set this base up actually on...
Danco Island.
Danco Coast, I think it is, isn't it? Anyway, they set this base up as a... Because what it amounts to is that they had parties going down from Hope Bay, and they could get down a certain distance, but Danco was halfway down the coast. They wanted something halfway down the coast, so they set this base up. And it turned out that they couldn't get up onto the peninsula very easily because of the glaciers. But anyway, that's by the way. What it amounts to is that one of the guys there, as part of the stuff that came down, he received a parcel. And what it amounts to is his, must have been his sister, maybe it was his girlfriend, who knows, but someone had put in one of these ladies' magazines, or Women's Own or something like that, you see. And so one of the other guys conceived the idea, so they wrote to the Woman's Own and said, oh, I got this base with the 5, 7, I can't remember any guys, a bunch of guys on here, and we haven't seen a woman in God knows how long. Well, there were stacks of bloody mail. I can't remember any, but they were on the check, and there was several stacks of mail. And there was a bunch of stacks there already, you see, and this base is closed now, you see. So anyway, you know, what do? You start riffling through them and, you know, you're looking...
So they were distributed across the bases, were these letters?
No, they're all Danco. They're all there. At Danco closed. So what it amounts to is that we went in and we dropped a bunch of these sacks of mail off, and then we said, well, okay, we'll look through them, and we were sorting out, you know, which ones we wanted, you know, and the idea, the criteria, I mean, you got a whole bunch of these things, you know, criterion is, okay, which one's got photographs in, you know, you know, so you choose a whole bunch of these things, you know, maybe a dozen, and I thought, well, okay, but, you know, I thought to myself, hey, I'm on my way down, 2 years I'm going to be going back. If I communicate with anyone, it's going to be a long-distance process, you see, and I wasn't all that concerned. Now, apparently, someone did do that, and they communicated with some young lady, and they ended up getting married to her. Well, that's good, you know. That's but I wasn't that concerned about it, but I just thought that was funny that there was a whole pile of these things. Some of them had some pretty alluring pictures in them, too.
Oh, really? Again, scantily.
No nudity, but...
okay.
Some very alluring young ladies.
The man who had the initiative may have been Duncan Boston. Does that name ring a bell?
No, it doesn't.
Who was base leader at Danco.
Well, yeah, but there was nobody there when we went there. So, okay. I mean, I guess he'd gone. He'd maybe went the year. I mean, because that could have been you know, a year before we went down, because they, you know, yeah, that the way the mail worked, it could have been in the works. You know, those, that bag of mail could have been in Port Stanley for a year, for Christ's sake, couldn't it?
And BBC Radio, your family were herded into a BBC studio at one point.
My family was, yes. They I think, was it once a month they could get on and talk to us over the radio or something like that. They had a script. They had a definite. I got, in fact, I have copies of the script somewhere. Or they had a. They submitted a script and they were allowed to talk over the radio because there was no interaction. I couldn't talk back to them, but I could listen to them. And you know,
was this calling Antarctica?
It may have been. Yeah, yeah.
You're the first person to say that they had to write a script. This wasn't ad lib then. It wasn't off the cuff. It was scripted.
Well, it was too. I guess it was off the cuff to a certain extent, but I've got a copy of the script. I mean, I believe that my folks produced the script. I mean, I definitely have copies of the script, of some scripts. Maybe that was just a guide, you know. Okay, you know, what are you going to talk about? And they give you you write down what you think. Because, you know, the thing is, you could be on the radio and people could get all tongue tied. I mean, you're in a BBC studio, especially like my folks, you know. They're not used to that sort of stuff, you know. So.
Yeah, it would have been pre-recorded. It wouldn't have been live.
I don't know. Maybe. I don't know. It could be. It was pre-recorded.
I think it was, yeah.
I don't know.
Were you able to hear it all the time?
As far as I'm aware, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, we could hear it pretty well, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Some fizz learned to cook in the Antarctic. Were you one of them?
Let me put it this way. I was a cook every 5 weeks, so let me say this. You're doing cooking. The cook wasn't required to do anything else. So, you know, you were on cook. And you had basically 5 meals a day to produce. You got breakfast, you got smoko, morning smoko, you got lunch or dinner, and afternoon smoko and an evening meal. And you also had to produce, you had to produce some, I think you had to leave some like 5 loaves of bread for the next guy. This is a biblical situation. and you had to produce, you know, a bunch of nutritious meals. You had a certain amount of basic stuff to use. If you were lucky, you got a ham, because there was something like, I can't remember, maybe a dozen hams available. So they turned up on a periodic basis, and the idea was to make sure everybody got them in turn, sort of thing, you see. So it was all very egalitarian. There was two things I remember about cooking. The thing is that, you know, I'd been in college, so I knew a bit about cooking, and I knew, you know, the basics of cooking, and we had a bunch of, you know, Mrs. Beaton's cookbook and all that sort of stuff to use. So I'm not unhappy with cooking. I quite like cooking, but there was a couple of things. One is that at one point, when I first, my first meal there, in the cupboard there, we had all these tins of stuff, and one of them was these tins of steak and kidney pudding, you see. Now, in my house, steak and kidney pudding, I used to love. My mother used to do that, cook one of those things with a bunch of chips. That was great. So I thought, okay, this is great. This is a meal, you see. So I put this stuff on the table, and everybody went, you see. Now, my attitude is this. Okay, I'm the cook. I don't have the same attitude as my wife or anything like that. I'm the cook. That's it. You don't like it, you know where the kitchen is. Get on with it, boy. Yeah. There's enough bread there, plenty of jam. Away you go. But at the same time, you say, okay, I'm not going to produce that same thing again. And you know, I enjoyed experimenting and stuff. You know, making bread was easy for me. Was easy because my mother made it all the time. So and she the stove that we had in the Antarctic was exactly the same stove that she had back home. So, you know, I knew exactly how to do it, what to do, and the whole thing. So the cooking was For me, it was okay. It wasn't a chore.
But surely the trickiest part was finding fresh ingredients from the wild around you.
Well, let me say, first of all, you didn't have to find fresh ingredients from the wild, but we did on occasion. We'd get penguin eggs when we could. We'd get shag eggs when we could. And we'd get the odd penguin and the odd seal. From my point of view, funny experience Lewis there.
George
Lewis.
Is this the first catch your shag story?
Yeah, this is the first. Yeah, what it amounts to is
to paraphrase Mrs. Beeson.
Yeah, he decided that he wanted to. He wanted to branch out and cook a shag, you see. So I said, okay. So we went down to, took the boat and went down to Shag Rocks, okay. And Shag Rocks, you get all these shags, which are cormorants, incidentally, all these shags are nesting on the rocks all the way up. And like all the Antarctic wildlife, they're as tame as anything. So what it amounts to is that you go walk up to them, pat them on the head and all this sort of stuff. Now, George was a big gun enthusiast. So when we were in Port Stanley, he went in and he says, "Oh boy, I can buy myself." Actually, "oh boy" was not one of his expressions, but "oh, I can buy myself a 303 rifle." Good for you. So he bought a 303 rifle, and he tended this down thing. So we get down to Shag Rocks, and he decides he's going to have a shag. Now, a shag has a very thin neck, about maybe an inch wide, and a small head. And he says, "Well, I'm going to shoot this thing, but I'll only shoot it in the body because then it'll destroy everything, you see. So I'm going to shoot it in the head." Okay. So he lines up about 6 feet away from this poor old shag, who's looking him straight in the eye, pulls the trigger. There's the most enormous bang. The shag jumps up and flies off. Uh-oh. So it flies back again, and I thought, "By Jove, you're a devil of a punishment." Shaking his head a bit and looking, giving George the evil eye this time. Lines up again, bang! The shag jumps up and flies off. I can't remember if he did it two or three times, but eventually the shag obviously thought, "You know what, it's getting a little too noisy up there." So George says, I don't understand this, you see. So then he decides he still has to have a shag. So now he's got to get one and he's going to basically wring his neck. Well, I tell you, that he discovered wringing any bird's neck is not easy, and wringing the shag's neck is I think he ended up beating it to death with a bloody oar paddle out the boat. It was... I'm laughing, but I mean it was a complete disaster. And the shag was very much like, when we ate it was very much like penguin. I mean, the penguin is the penguin and seals, the flesh is kind of like liver. It's got a lot of hemoglobin in it. I think what it amounts to is when they dive in, they store oxygen in the hemoglobin, and it's in everything. So, I mean, I like liver, so that was fine. But the shag was, it was okay when it was cooked, but getting it was, like he says, a Mrs. Beaton moment, you know, first catch your hare.
Did you ever have it again?
Huh?
Did he ever have shag again?
We didn't have shag again. We had penguins. I mean, he had a similar... What he discovered in the end, he did some research and discovered that the bullet comes out and jumps off to one side about 3 inches, which was enough to completely miss the bloody shag. So. He says he's once great at 100 yards. I said, "Yeah, but, you know, 100 yards away, you'd be in the Darcy's Sea, for goodness sake."
you talked earlier about the long, dark-ish winter days, and how you would read a great deal. And in order to facilitate your reading, you built yourself an armchair.
That's right, yeah. Yeah.
Out of what?
Well, what it amounts to is that I'm a bit of a riddle bottom, as you may notice, but well, the chairs were okay, but they weren't that comfortable, you see. And I thought, well, you know, I think I can build an armchair. So what I did was, we had all sorts of, in the Nissen hut, we had all sorts of stuff. Hmm. And we had a bunch of this light Meccano, Dexian angle. So I just got a bunch of Dexian angle, and I built the outline of a chair. And then, excuse me, to provide webbing, we had a bunch of cable for, telephone-type cable, signalling cable, and I just strung it with that. And then we had these foam beds, you know, the foam mattresses. So I just hung that over the back of it, and I had my armchair. And I said, boy, this is great, you see. And I says to George, I said, you want me to make you one? No, he didn't want one. No, nobody else wanted one. I don't know what the hell happened to it in the end, but anyway.
And was there a considerable library to read from?
There was a lot of stuff, yes. There was a lot of stuff to read, a lot of mysteries and stuff like that. There's also a fair amount of Antarctic literature, you know, Shackleton and all these other, Mawson and all these other guys. You know, you read a certain amount of that and you think, I don't know, you can read a certain amount of that and you think, you know, if you read too much of that, you're going to start getting yourself worried about it. It gets a little repetitious, you know, okay, been there, done that. So, but mysteries, you know, Agatha Christie and all these others, they were light reading.
You can only read those once, couldn't you? Because you knew the outcome.
You can, but we had a heck of a lot of them, so that's okay.
I mean, I get the impression, particularly at Port Loughborough, that the Finns didn't get off base much, but you made a trip to the Chilean base. Tell me the story of that, please.
I like, you see, the thing is that, I wouldn't say I resented but I like to get out. And I was the sort of guy who would, especially in the summer, I'd get up at 2 o'clock in the morning and think, well, okay, I think I'll go off. I'll go skiing. I mean, at least a couple of times I went 2 o'clock in the morning and I said, okay, that's it. And the only form of motorised transport you got, okay, you jump in the boat, and I'd go tooled off down the other end of Ambers Island there to see what there was around there. I think I got just about as far around as the there's now an American base there, but there's nothing there in my day. But anyway, and I remembered the story of Dave Price had about the guys from the Chilean, I think it was a Chilean base, or this, who came across to help with Muir Smith. So I thought, I wouldn't mind doing that. So right at the very end of my tenure, this guy, Dave Hounsell, came in. And he was a new guy, so I could persuade him to do all sorts of things, you see. And I said, you know, I'm thinking of having a trip over the mainland there, you see. And he, not knowing a whole hell of a lot what was what, he said, hey, that sounds good, you see. So I said, okay. So one morning we got in the boat and I said, okay, we're going to the Chileno base. And we tootled off. We went up the end of Wienke Island, I think it is there, right?
Yeah.
Up the end of the island. And there was a little beach or something there, and we stopped and we looked at it and said, oh, okay, that's where we're going across there. Okay, fine. And we started out across. It's quite wide. And so we plodded that across, and about halfway across, it got misty. And Dave's saying, oh, how do we know which way to go? I says, well, no, I'm just keeping the wind in the same direction. And about 15, 20 minutes later, it cleared up. Okay, where we go. So we motored into the bay on the other side there. The current was a bit fierce. There was big lumps of ice were busy rushing past us. So anyway, we landed there, and there was a bunch of guys on this Chileno base, and we greeted them, and they were saying, oh, where's the boat? Where's the boat? They thought we'd come off a cruise ship or something, you see. I said, no, we came from Port La Croix. And I looked at them, you've got to be nuts. They said, probably in Spanish. The problem was that we couldn't communicate back to base. We got the radio with us, but it it was, you know, we hadn't got the right frequency, and we tried with the Chilean radio, and okay. So the next day we, because I was intending to stay in an extra, a day or so, just to, have a meeting with the South Americans.
How did you get on with them? Because they were the enemy, weren't they?
No. Nobody's the enemy in the Antarctic. You don't get enemies. They were the guys who sent a bloody doctor across to Dr. Lemuel Smith the year before, for God's sake. And they risked their lives to do that. So, there's only one enemy, and that's the blasted weather. So anyway, they were very friendly. And as I say, we got on with, I think there's one or two of them could speak enough English. So anyway, we went back. And of course, when we got back, they said, oh, where were you all? You know, Sec Fids is all worried and blah, blah, blah. And then apparently they sent the rescue. They diverted the John Biscoe. Uh-oh, sorry, guys. And I think after that, Fids decided, get that bugger off the...
So you could hear the bass, but the bass couldn't hear you. You could hear...
No, we couldn't hear either way.
You couldn't hear either way?
No, we couldn't hear either way. We didn't know what was happening. If we'd have known, well, it wouldn't make any difference. I mean, we were not going to go straight off back. We went back the next day.
And you were amazed to hear the sound of bleating sheep at the Chilean base.
Yeah, they had sheep there. They had live sheep. They kept... I think they said they kept the sheep for quite a while. Well, they kept sheep and butchered them when they when they ran out of they had bales of hay, right? When they ran out of the hay, or when they were feeling peckish. I guess that's a good way to keep fresh meat.
That was right towards the end of your time in the Antarctic. I wonder, as departure loomed, whether you were feeling glad to get out or very sorry to leave. What was your feelings at that time?
Well, I've always been in a situation where I kind of... I'm looking forward to the next step. I'm not sort of... I don't get, I'm really sorry to leave. But at the same time, if they turned around and said, you want to stay another year? I'd probably said, yeah, sure. I got to get out of here, and I wasn't at the same time saying, I've really missed the guys and all that sort of stuff. I was looking forward to traveling further south and also, getting home eventually. But I wasn't desperate. Let's put it that way.
But you got delayed on the way back. You were stuck in South Africa for a couple of months.
Yeah, we did. Yeah, we. That was good. I thought it was great. on the way back, we got to South Africa, and the ship had been commissioned. I'm not sure whether it was the South African government or the French government, but they had to go to Ile de Kerguelen, I think it was, out in the Indian Ocean. And they said, okay, we've got this commission to go and basically take supplies out to this island, you see, way out in the sub-Antarctic part of the Indian Ocean. And I believe all of us turned around and said, tell you what, been there, done that. give us an advance and I'll pay and we'll stay here. So at least five of us. What happened was that we rented a car, and at this point, I didn't have a driver's license. Just trying to remember who else didn't have a driver's license. But there was me, Barry Williamson, Evan Watson, and Paddy somebody or this.
Would you have taken your driving licenses with you to the Antarctic?
Well, it's like this. I didn't have one. I didn't have one in England, so...
Exactly. Anyway, go on. What's the point you're trying to make?
Well, the point is there's only two of us could drive, or only two of them could drive. So, and we're renting a car, you had to have a driver's license, you see. So, one of them was this guy, I can't remember his name now, Patrick somebody or other. Anyway, he was a big, tall guy, and nobody would like to be driving with him because he was the scariest bloody driver you've ever been seen. And so what it amounts to is that, and then we had this car with, you know, the old-fashioned where the front seats were all together, bench front seats, you see. So he was driving, so I would drive, I would sit with him because I could fall asleep while he was driving. And we went all, we spent, you know, at least a month and a half driving around South Africa. We went up to the, what's it, Kruger National Park and various other places. We had a ball.
Very, very different from where you've been.
It was a bit of a change, yes. It was a bit of a change. I like South Africa, and I like, Cape Town. Cape Town was good. I thought Cape Town was great because Cape Town was the only town I've ever been in where I got a bus into town in order to be able to climb a mountain. I thought that was great.
you had a very substantial and interesting career after FIDS, working on computers, atomic energy, linear accelerators, and so on. Quite an interesting engineering career. We haven't got time to go into that now, but what I would like to know is whether you feel that there was anything you learned in the Antarctic which stood you in good stead later in your life, either in your career or in handling people. Did you change in those 2 years?
Actually, no, I wouldn't. Let me say this. Everything I learned down there was of great value. But thinking back on it, I've been married for 51 years, and the biggest value of living on the base, and especially that base, is learning how to get on with other people with different views and different backgrounds. And as far as I'm concerned, that's the best training for being married. I mean, you know, I'm happily married, but the thing is, you're married, you've got to get on with somebody, and you've got to get on with somebody pretty much. And living on base is even worse than being married because, you know, being married, you go out to work, so you only interact with your wife maybe 3 or 4 hours a day. You're on base with those guys, and you're acting pretty, you're reacting or interacting something like 24 hours a day. There's not a lot of getting out.
That's the best answer I've ever had to that question. Thank you, Paul. Well done. Ha 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 ha.